You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1988 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the third class in a series given by Brother Ken Wubbles on the subject, Paul's Work as a Missionary.
So what did we talk about on Tuesday? In order for people to see the truth, what did Paul have to do in his message? He had to make his message clear, concise, and complete. There's one passage in 1 Thessalonians 2 where he more or less summarizes the way in which he made or phrased his appeal to the churches where he preached. 1 Thessalonians, the second chapter, starting in verse 3 and reading through verse 8. Thou said up here too as well, in addition to being clear, concise, and complete, that he empathized with his listeners. He looked for that common ground that he had with them. Certainly in the case of the church at Antioch in Acts chapter 13 that we looked at on Tuesday, the common ground that he was trying to establish with both his Jews and Gentile audience was not only addressing them all as brethren, but listing the common salvation that they had had in the past, all the way from coming out of Egypt to the time of Jesus, and having established that empathy, that common ground, that need of another salvation, because the others, after all, were only incomplete. They were in need of an eternal salvation. So Paul simply summarizes in 1 Thessalonians 2 the way in which he approached people when he says, "For our appeal does not spring from error or uncleanness, nor is it made with guile. For just as we have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, so we speak, not to please men, as he was accused of in the letter of the Galatians by some, not to please men, but to please God who tests our hearts. For we never used either words of flattery, as you know, or a cloak of greed, as God is witness, nor did we seek glory from men, as he was accused in the letter of the Galatians of seeking glory from men. Nor did we seek glory from men, whether from you or from others, though we might have made demands as apostles in Christ, but we were gentle among you, like a nurse taking care of her children." And that's a figure of speech which all of us can understand. Both mothers and fathers, how carefully they cradle their children and nurture them. And that was the way Paul felt towards those in Antioch, Lystra, Iconium, and Derbe. "Being gentle among you, like a nurse taking care of her children, and so being affectionately desirous of you, we were ready to share with you not only the gospel of God, but also our own selves, because you had become very dear to us." And I would suspect that any of us writing a letter which we're trying to express our emotions of how we feel about somebody would be very hard-pressed to pass the words which Paul just used in his letter to the Thessalonians: affectionately desirous, gentle, ready to share, giving of our own selves. You are very dear to us. So that was the Apostle Paul's approach to preaching. And that's not to say that he didn't have another side to him when somebody deliberately withstood him and what they knew to be truth. He could be very harsh as well, but he wasn't that way when he preached. What else did we talk about on Tuesday? Give you a hint. Starts with the letter A, home ecclesia. Okay. Talked about Antioch as the prototypical home ecclesia, the outward thinking ecclesia, the place from which Paul always started and from which he always ended his missionary journeys. That the church in Antioch, as an outward thinking of ecclesia, their feelings went with Paul, as well as their visible means of support. He didn't support himself on that first missionary journey. At least there's no evidence of it. The conclusion is that as he left for Cyprus, not only the names of some relatives he could contact in Cyprus were put into his hand, funds as well, so that he and Barnabas could devote themselves full time to the work of preaching the gospel. And yet, when they came back some 2 years later, the first place Paul goes is he goes to the church in Antioch. And that telling verse in chapter 14, when he comes back, Acts chapter 14, verse 27, the church had laid their hands on Paul and Barnabas, sending them out. And the complementary verse to that is verse 27 of chapter 14. When they arrived, they gathered the church together and declared all that God had done with them and how he had opened a door of faith to the Gentiles. And that was the main thrust of the first missionary journey. If you want to summarize it in a few words, a door has been opened. That dividing wall of hostility has been broken down. But the dividing wall of hostility, as we went on to talk on Tuesday, was still there in the eyes of some. And we go into chapter 15 in the book of Acts, and we read about that circumcision party who were still bringing this issue to the forefront. There was a need to be circumcised in order to be a member of the church. And Acts chapter 15 details the conference in Jerusalem to resolve that problem once and for all. And once it was resolved, Paul and the church in Antioch take it upon themselves to let all the other churches where Paul had just preached, those throughout Galatia, to let them know that there was nothing to be added to what Paul had already preached to them. However, the circumcision party didn't let it rest there. They took it upon themselves to follow in Paul's footsteps after he had gone through at the beginning of his second missionary journey, following in his footsteps, saying, Paul was not really sincere with you. Although he said he was in Thessalonians, that was his method. They said, no, he's not really being on the up and up with you. He still is trying to do this just to please you. He's lowering our standards so that the gates can be opened and more people can become Christians. Not only that, as proof of that, look at Timothy, one of your own from Lystra. Wasn't he circumcised? And the whole issue came to the forefront again. And as a result of that falling away due to the preaching of those Judaizers, the letter to the Galatians was written. And if you look at the introductory passage in the letter to the Galatians, look and see who wrote that letter. It certainly starts off in the first verse, and we very rarely get past that first verse where it says Paul. But then, as Paul often does, there's a long parenthesis, as it were, and it's not down until we get to the end of that introductory passage that we see who assisted Paul in the writing of that letter. Galatians, the first chapter. Which Antioch? He started out from Antioch in Syria. There are two Antiochs. One is in Syria. The other is actually in Phrygia, they call it. In Galatians 1, the introduction, Paul, an apostle, etc., 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 etc. Verse 2, and all the brethren who are with me. Now, who were those brethren who were with Paul when he wrote the letter to the Galatians? Again, perhaps a matter for speculation in the minds of some, but in my mind it's very clear that it was the brethren in the church at Antioch in Syria who, still mindful of their obligations to these brethren to whom one of their own had preached, had their own best interests at heart, and needing to resolve the question for their brethren in other countries, took it upon themselves, together with the Apostle Paul, to address this letter to those in their city namesake, Antioch in Phrygia. That's what we talked about on Tuesday, in case you had forgotten. We ended up the class on Tuesday by putting in a parenthesis about divine guidance. How Paul, on his second missionary journey, if you can visualize a map in your mind, left from Antioch, retraced his steps, going through the churches of Derbe, Lystra, Iconium, and Antioch once again. And how at each step of the way, seemingly there was some form of divine guidance. In one case, the Spirit, the Holy Spirit spoke, and we hypothesize perhaps through Silas, who now accompanying Paul, being a prophet himself, said to Paul that God, he had received a message from God, that he was not to go into Asia. The Spirit of Jesus forbade him from going into Bithynia, again, perhaps through Silas, or perhaps Silas knew something that Paul didn't, that Peter, was intending a missionary journey to Bithynia, because the first letter of Peter is signed by his secretary, who at that time was Silvanus, the same as Silas. And as he travels up now, his path to the east being blocked, his path to the west being blocked, he goes up to the coast, almost on the doorstep of going into Europe, a man of Macedonia, perhaps Luke, we don't know for sure, a vision to confirm that he is to cross over the sea to go to Macedonia, and he ends up in Philippi. Assured in his own mind that this is God guiding him. But then look what happened to him. Divine guidance is not a guarantee of divine protection from all possibilities, all ill effects. In Philippi, we know the story, and as he relates it later in one of his letters to the Thessalonians, he says he was shamefully treated. And we know the story of how he was jailed and beaten. And leaving Philippi, being asked to leave the town, he continued on to Thessalonica. And again, we know the story of what happened to them in Thessalonica. Again, in reading in the letter to the Thessalonians, he talks about, and in the book of Acts, in chapter 16, he talks about how they had to leave at night, under the cover of darkness, that his life was in such peril. Divine guidance is not a guarantee of divine protection from all ill. And leaving Thessalonica in fear for his life, he moves down to Berea, the ecclesia that we always remember for those who were noble, more noble than those of Thessalonica, who searched out the scriptures daily. But again, the Jews from Thessalonica searching out Paul drove him out of Berea as well and down to Athens. And it mentions that the brethren had to take him down to Athens. And that it must have been a very lonely period at this time in the life of Paul, because he was now by himself, his two helpers, Silas and Timothy, having been left behind to firm up the work that he had done throughout Thessalonica and Berea. He finds himself all alone, certainly one of the most devastating feelings that one can have, a foreign country by yourself, with no believers. And he goes in Athens to preach once more with very, very little effect. It mentions only two people who were converted as a result of his speech on Mars Hill, his special speech where he looks at the altar of the unknown God, again establishing that common ground that he has with them. This is the one whom I'm coming to talk to you about. You already have an altar to him. Well, I'm here to explain about him. Because as he works his way down from Macedonia into Achaia, he leaves Athens, the work on fruitful, now not only desolate and lonely, perhaps sick, and now he arrives in Corinth. And when we read again of the way he felt when he went into Corinth, we're now in Acts 18, just following an historical narrative, the phrase that it uses, Chapter 18 of Acts, verses 9 and 10. The Lord said to Paul one night in a vision, and the Lord didn't come to Paul often in a vision. He only came at moments of crisis. He said to him in a vision, "Do not be afraid, but speak, and do not be silent, for I am with you. No man shall attack you to harm you, for I have many people in this city." Paul at this point needed reassurance that what had happened to him, the way he had been directed with divine guidance, was not going to happen again. That he wasn't going to have to go through the beatings, through the imprisonments, through the sickness, through the desolation, through the loneliness that was so common in his life. In fact, he writes to the Corinthians that when I was among you, I was with you in fear and trembling. 1 Corinthians 2. A telling phrase in itself, used a number of times in the New Testament. Can you imagine the Apostle Paul in fear and in trembling in the city of Corinth? But keep in mind that that phrase doesn't mean his knees were knocking and that he was afraid to stand up and preach, but rather what that means is that he was with them in obedience to divine guidance. Take a look at Philippians, a verse that we're all familiar with. I believe it's the second chapter in Philippians. Paul was in Corinth as a result of fear and trembling. Philippians 2, verse 12. Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, key word, so now, not only in my presence, but much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. We're not to obey God with our knees knocking. Fear and trembling is a synonymous word with obedience. Paul was in Corinth because God had led him there. And so we must be led as well. Back to Acts chapter 18. The narrative in the church at Corinth begins with a much-needed respite for the Apostle Paul. Being alone and desolate, God provides him with the company that he needs. After he left Athens, verse 1 of chapter 18, he went to Corinth and he found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, lately come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome. The prototypical, as it were, married missionary couple. And perhaps an aside here at this point. If you do decide at any point in your life that you would like to do missionary work and you happen to be married, a word of advice is that make sure you're agreed amongst yourselves, between the two of you, that this is something you want to do. If you find that one spouse has strong feelings and the other is hesitant, they may be due to a natural hesitancy on the part of one simply because they need reassurance. But if it is an act of disagreement that you'll not benefit at all from being put in that pressure cooker, as it were, which will only put strains on your marriage if there's no agreement before you go. But Priscilla and Aquila seem to be that kind of couple who were in complete agreement about what they wanted to do. And just take it aside for a moment and think about the events in the life of Priscilla and Aquila. Lately from Rome, originally from Pontus, one of those provinces where in Acts chapter 2 we read there were some Jews in Jerusalem who had heard the speech of Peter on the day of Pentecost. They played host to the church in Corinth, and they played host to Paul as well. And as Paul left Corinth a year and a half later, they went along with him to Ephesus and again played host to the church in Ephesus and again played host to Paul as well. And who Paul says in Romans chapter 16, risked their very necks for my life. They were the same couple who took aside Apollos and instructed him more perfectly in the way of God. What better example could we as married missionary couples have than to look at Priscilla and Aquila as somebody to emulate, who were in complete agreement about what they wanted to do and went wherever they had to go to be of assistance and went so far as to risk their lives for their friend Paul. They were in Corinth, and certainly a comfort to Paul in his moment of loneliness. He went to see them, in verse 2, stayed with them because they were of the same trade. Verse 4, and he argued in the synagogue every Sabbath and persuaded Jews and Greeks. There are versions which would seem to indicate that as Paul went into the synagogue, and as he was called to the front to do the scripture reading, he had the audacity that when he came to the word for the Messiah, he would interject the word Jesus. And so when he's reading passages such as in Isaiah 53 about the Messiah, he would interject the word Jesus. And so it is in 1 Corinthians, we read that phrase, anybody who says, Jesus be cursed, we can just see the Jews sitting in the synagogue week after week hearing this term interjected where it wasn't in the text. And it was simply a matter of interpretation on the part of Paul. Eventually they get so disgusted they stand up in the back of the synagogue, shake their fist at him and say, Jesus be cursed. Read it the way it's supposed to be. But Paul continued. Silas and Timothy now returned from their side trips, having gone through the churches in Macedonia, returned to Paul in Corinth, and see that Paul is now his being reanimated. He's coming back to life again. Perhaps his sickness having now abated, he now has the company of others who are of similar to belief. He's occupied with preaching and teaching and testifying to the Jews that Christ was Jesus, despite what those in the synagogue may say about his readings. When they opposed and reviled him, he shook out his garments and said to them, your blood be upon your heads. I am innocent. From now on I will go to the Gentiles. A very typical reaction. And so the emphasis once again shifts to the other side of the dividing wall. And now we begin to pick up and talk about the emphasis on converts. The church in Corinth, as we all know from reading 1 and 2 Corinthians, was a church very much like our own. People quite often would ask, when you live in a foreign country and they read in the newspapers about the life in a foreign country, would ask questions such as, what do you do when you get tired of all the violence and the immorality in these countries? And I say, well, I simply go back to Mexico where I came from, since I was in the United States when they were asking me the question. We seem to think that our own country has a higher sense of morality than other countries do, and that we don't experience in the Christadelphian body the same degree of problems that they do in other countries. And that's not true. We're not unique in this country. And in that sense, when I talk about the composition of the church at Corinth, even though I'm talking in the context of foreign missionary work, I'm not neglecting the fact that, at least in my own feelings, I'm talking about our ecclesias here as well. The church in Corinth was composed of all kinds of people. And in looking at 1 Corinthians and the composition of that book, we see that it basically is divided into a number of sections. The first section we call Corinthian Problems, where Paul deals with, first of all, in the first four chapters, the problem of divisions in that church in Corinth. There were some who said they were of Paul, some said they were of Apollos, some said they were of Christ, some said they were of Cephas. Not at all like we have here in the United States. It's a very common problem in foreign countries. There was immorality amongst the church in Corinth. There was a brother who was living with his father's wife. Immorality that Paul said should not be found among you. Certainly we don't find that in our own ecclesias here in the United States. There was a problem going on to chapter 6. Brethren bringing each other to court over various lawsuits. There was a problem with brethren whose consciences just could not allow them to eat meat that had been sacrificed to idols. And there were brethren who didn't consider that an important aspect at all and would do it very freely. And so some were offended by others. And then there was also the problem in the Corinthian church of the breaking of bread. In chapters 10 and 11, where Paul details the fact that we still know that the breaking of bread was attached somehow to a communal meal, and that there were some who, when they were coming to the breaking of bread, were eager to get on with a meal. Perhaps they were hungry, and so that they started their meal, and they actually came to the breaking of bread, that culmination of their common meal, and they were actually drunk. Unheard of. It happened to me. There was a baptism in the country where we were working at the time. Two sisters had declared their faith. We went out on a long bus trip out to the country where the water was, where we could baptize them. We had asked a brother, a local brother, to do the presiding at the baptismal service. And the brother, for whatever reason, felt perhaps pressure to conform. He felt perhaps inadequate to the task. Took solace in drink. He was drunk, but had the dedication, perhaps you might say, to ride 3 hours on the bus in the state that he was and arrived in a drunken state, unable to perform the service. Unheard of in Corinth. Doesn't happen these days. It does happen, brethren and sisters. It does happen. And I dare say it happens more often than we dare admit. But it happened in the church at Corinth. They were actually drunk at the breaking of bread service. Those who wanted to start early were unable to see it in their minds to wait for those who arrived a little bit later. And those who were late couldn't see to arrange their schedule so that they would arrive at the proper time. And not only that, given the breaking of bread service, it was a hubbub. There was no order. There was no things done decently and in order as Paul exhorted them. They were some who had spirit gifts, who in the midst of the service, in order to give others the benefit of their gift, would stand up and begin to speak in tongues, when nobody could understand what they were saying. And another person would stand up and say, I have something that I think is just wonderful. I want to explain to you. Everybody listen to me. And there were other people who were doing various and sundry things. And it was just, as far as our meetings are concerned, a mess. And such are our converts. What do you do to solve that kind of problem? And you run into it all the time. How do you pull it all together and make it work? How do you pull all these diverse elements together into one unified body? And having gone in a very quick synopsis of chapters 1 through 12 in 1 Corinthians, we arrive at chapter 13. And you have to read chapter 13 in light of the first 12 chapters. If you'll permit me to paraphrase chapter 13 with you, you can turn to it in your Bibles. But just bear with me as I paraphrase it in my own words. How does an apostle pull together all these diverse elements into one unified body? He says in verse 1, you can have the most obvious and impressive of spirit gifts, but it must be used for others. It doesn't matter whether you've got the gift. What matters is what you do with it. In verse 2, you can have tremendous insight and understanding of the scriptures, but that's not the end goal in itself. It's what you do with it. Verse 3, you can be extremely self-sacrificing, but unless you give in the proper spirit, your giving is worthless. Verse 4, you must be patient and kind. And that's that same word that we saw for Christians. You have to be Christian-like, kind. Towards problems of dissensions and in problems dealing with marriage. In dealing with, I am of Paul, I am of Apollos, I of Cephas, I of Paul, the solution is being patient and kind towards others. Verse 4, if you have a spirit gift, don't flaunt it. Don't look at somebody else's gift and say, I wish I had that. Because when you do that, you bestow more importance on the gift itself than on the one who gave it. And the one who merits the honor is the giver. Don't disrupt a meeting or ask to be recognized for the express purpose of getting in the last word. Things need to be done decently, with respect, and in order. You may be irritated by people who arrive late at your meeting, or you may be irritated that they started without you, but be patient. Order your life so that you have time to arrive at the proper hour, lest, as he says in chapter 11, when you come together, your feeling of irritation be your condemnation. Verse 6, don't say I told you so when you're proved right on a point of interpretation. Rather, take satisfaction in the fact that the word of God is convincing in matters of doctrine and conduct. Verse 7, mutual respect and understanding has a way of putting up with a lot of problems until they can be resolved. In fact, it is the solution. And it's not by accident that the same word that's used in this chapter for charity or love is the same word that Jesus used when he instituted the Last Supper in John chapter 13. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. And that's the word which is used for the breaking of bread. And that's where it all comes down to and focuses. That's where it was all focused in the church at Corinth. That's where all these problems came to the forefront when they came gathered together to remember the Lord's death. In those verses that we read every Sunday morning, all these problems had their focus. And they all have their solution, if we remember what that's all about. So that's how Paul sought to bring all these diverse elements together into one group. Did it work? Or does it work? It works to the degree that we can live his advice. He spent a year and a half in Corinth, and his converts there didn't heed his advice completely. There were other trips that he had to make back to Corinth. But a year and a half was sufficient time. The foundation had been laid. It's now time to return to Jerusalem. After all, there are rumblings back there. Galatia is about to defect. He returns through Ephesus, Priscilla and Aquila accompanying him, gives the people, the Jews in the synagogue at Ephesus, a taste of the gospel, begs their pardon, leaves Priscilla and Aquila there, but he himself returns to Jerusalem. And we're now into chapter 19. Excuse me, chapter 18 still. Verse 22 and 23. When he had landed at Caesarea, he went up and greeted the church, and then went down to Antioch. And after spending some time there, he departed and went from place to place throughout the region of Galatia and Phrygia, strengthening the disciples. While he is in Asia, the province that had been forbidden to him on the second missionary journey is now a door wide open to him to do work and to put into practice his missionary methods. And it's on that third missionary journey, while he was in Ephesus, that we can begin to get a picture of what daily life was like for the Apostle Paul. He spent some 3 years in Ephesus, the first few months of those in the synagogue itself. And as we look at the 19th chapter in Acts, we see that again his main opposition came from the Jews who were in the synagogue. 19, verse 8. He entered the synagogue and for 3 months spoke boldly, arguing and pleading about the kingdom of God. But when some were stubborn and disbelieved, speaking evil of the way before the congregation, he withdrew from them, taking the disciples with him, and argued daily in the hall of Tyrannus. This continued for 2 years, so that all the residents of Asia heard the word of the Lord, both Jews and Greeks. As we go on and read more about the Apostle Paul in Ephesus, his typical day would look something like this. A typical missionary day. He worked and supported himself and others. We read about the sweat cloths which Paul wore, that when he took them off, when they became saturated, became objects that people wanted, almost revered objects, much as Peter's shadow was in those first days after the ascension of Jesus. And it would seem that he rose with sunlight and worked till about 11 o'clock in the morning, doing hard physical labor. From 11 o'clock in the morning till about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, he dedicated that portion of his day to preaching in a hired hall from one Tyrannus, who in the cool of the day, when the majority of the students would be their liveliest, did his teaching and was eager to rent it out for the extra income in the afternoon. And so Paul rented the hall and used it as a central teaching point. You would think that that would be enough, working a full day, preaching for 5 hours, but his day went on. It talks later in the 20th chapter of Acts about how he went from house to house, how he visited each person individually to speak to them. And that's probably what he did in the evening. And in his spare time, he found time to head a province-wide campaign. Asia itself, occupying the majority of what is now the western portion of Turkey, was a huge province. And it was from Ephesus that that whole province was evangelized, but not by Paul. It's interesting to look at the method that he used. He used a number of people. Can anybody tell me any of the names that would be associated with Paul during this particular period of his life? There were a number of people who helped him wherever he went. And the way he worked was not by going himself, but by sending other people. Now think first of all of the churches that were in Asia. Your first thought goes to where? Ephesus as the center. Now, Revelation, The letters to the churches are to the letters in the churches where? To the churches in Asia. Okay, so we have seven churches there. Whether you can name them all or not doesn't make any difference, but we know that there are at least seven other churches, well, six other, because Ephesus is included in Revelation. At least six other churches were established then. Can you think of any other churches that were in Asia? Laodicea, certainly that's one of the churches mentioned in Revelation. Thyatira as well. Sardis, Smyrna. Philadelphia. Thessalonica was in Macedonia, across the water. Derby? No, that's a province. Okay. Lystra and Derby, wrong side. No, you're not in Asia. Okay, take a look at one of your maps. What's more important to me is the people that he used during this period of time. A quick list, if you'll permit me. I can't remember them off the top of my head. See if you recognize any of these names, all associated with his time in Asia. Timothy, Titus, Erastus, Tychicus, Trophimus. You know who Trophimus was? He was an Ephesian himself. Remember the one that Paul was accused of taking into the temple? Gaius, Aristarchus, Priscilla, Aquila, Apollos, Epaphroditus, Onesiphorus, Epaphras. These are just the names that we can pick off very quick reading of this particular period in the life of Paul. Now, if you look where those people are from, Timothy was from Lystra. Titus was from Antioch, perhaps Antioch in Syria. Erastus from Corinth. Tychicus and Trophimus were probably Asians, perhaps from Ephesus. Gaius from Derbe. Aristarchus from Thessalonica. Priscilla and Aquila from Rome via Pontus, lately from Corinth. Apollos was from Alexandria, Epaphroditus also from Asia, Onesiphorus, I'm not sure, Ephesus was from Colossae. So what you have here is what the English call a campaign. You gather brethren and sisters from all over and you invite them to this area and say, we've got a door wide open, an opportunity to us here in Asia. So come and participate in the campaign. Not that these people were with him the entire 3 years. I imagine they came and went as they had opportunity. But it was a campaign directed by the Apostle Paul. Let's just take one of these people and trace the activity of Timothy while Paul was in Ephesus. We have and we can verify biblically that Timothy, while he was trained on the second missionary journey, he went to Colossae during this period to help Epaphras. He went to Macedonia. He went to Corinth. These were places where, again, the method that Paul used was he localized himself in one spot, kept himself there as the hub, and sent people out in all directions to assist him in the preaching. And that's the way it has to be done, brethren and sisters. No one person is capable of doing all the evangelization. And that's no secret. I mean, I'm not saying anything that is new. I'm just simply pointing out to you once again, if you want to know the method that was used in the first century, this is it. If we want to reap results similar to those that Paul reaped in the first century, this is the way we have to go about it. One person can't do it. Two people can't do it. The way that he went about it, well, once you're in a city, how do you go about contacting people? There are, again, many different ways. One of the ways that Paul used was that he worked through the family structure itself. If you look at Corinth as an example, and you see who he baptized, look at the first chapter in 1 Corinthians. It's interesting how often when Paul talks of his converts, he doesn't simply say, greet so-and-so. It says, greet so-and-so and everybody in his household. The example that I give here is in verse 16. I did also baptize the household of Stephanas. How many people, how many instances can you think of where Paul baptized not only the head of the household, but everybody else? Off the top of your head. Go through his missionary journey. Lydia and her household in Philippi. Another one. Philippian jailer and his household, another one. Chloe and the people of Chloe's house, another one. Okay. Would Timothy and his family qualify? His mother and his grandmother? Ted, he's not too happy about that one. Okay. I think we can at least count on a number of occasions where Paul, one of the methods that he seemed to use was, don't be satisfied with just one member of the family becoming a member of the truth. Work through family lines. I can remember an instance where this became very real to me. Working through contacts, people who had answered newspaper ads, and following up on these ads, knocking on the door one day, and it ended up that the place where I was knocking was not on the house or the door of the contact himself, but his father's house. That's the address he had given to me. Well, it just so happened he was there that day, he and his wife. They invited me, and I sat down, introduced myself, told them what I was all about. Well, it just so happened there are seven other children in the family. The grandmother and grandfather also live there. The father and the mother are also there. And they provide you a space by yourself, but the house is not so large that they can't overhear, nor do they want to ignore what you're doing there. After all, you're a stranger in their country. Well, a Bible class was started as a result of that. You go out to their house on a Saturday. Well, you just can't go out to somebody's house on a Saturday without some other family member showing up. So in the midst of a Bible class, in comes the sister and the brother-in-law with their two children. All the greetings go around. Well, how are you? I'm fine. What are you doing here anyway? We have a Bible class. Well, okay, fine, just keep on going. So they join the Bible class. Well, eventually they become interested enough to want to start their own. So you go over to their house. Now, where you started out with one class, now you have two. The next step was now in the house of the second brother. And lo and behold, his brother and sister-in-law show up. And they have an interest as well. So a third Bible class starts. And by now the father and the mother are very suspicious of what's going on because three of their children are involved. And they now want to know what's going on. And that's the way the gospel needs to spread, along those family lines, those natural paths, which was a method used so effectively by the Apostle Paul. And it still works. And that's, again, no surprise to us. We only have to look at the common family names at a Bible school such as this. Who are the names that are here? Well, you know who the families are. And you can point out to the interrelationships. So-and-so married so-and-so. And then they married so-and-so. And the family lines just go right through us. And we know that they're there. Again, it's no great revelation. It's simply common sense that the Apostle Paul used. Missionary methods. Paul's, in essence, came to one conclusion at the end of his lifetime. Take a look in 1 Corinthians 9. I guess I shouldn't say at the end of his lifetime. What method did he find most effective in preaching? 1 Corinthians, the 9th chapter. Again, the words we're familiar with, but just put them in this context of missionary work. Where in verse 19 he says, "For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all, that I might win the more." Key number one, when you're preaching, you go as a servant and establish that relationship. You are there to help them. "To the Jews I became as a Jew in order to win the Jews. To those under the law I became as one under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law, I became as one outside the law, not being without law toward God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak, I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, that I might," if you'll permit me to paraphrase, "that I might, by any method necessary, save some." Whatever works. That was Paul's method. Whatever it took, he was willing to give. "And I do it all for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings." Again, brethren and sisters, I'm not telling you anything new. I'm simply putting it in the context and saying, experience, at least my own, seems to verify what Paul did. Our missionary methods, be it in this country or be it in another, are simply do whatever it takes for the sake of the gospel. I don't know how much time I have left, but I want to stop here and give you a homework assignment for tomorrow. Tomorrow we'll be talking about the fruits of a missionary. And as your homework assignment, I want you to make a list of all those who played host to the Apostle Paul. Every instance, every reference where you can think of where it mentions that Paul stayed with so-and-so, write it down and see how many you can come up with. I'll give you a goal to work toward. Somewhere in the vicinity of 15. And we'll see how many you can come up with tomorrow.